walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is actress Ashley Bell, who directed the new feature-length documentary Love and Bananas, an elephant story, which chronicles the rescue in Thailand of a 70-year-old partially blind Asian elephant and the ensuing 480-mile trip to a sanctuary and a new life, shepherded by Lek Shilert, a highly revered Asian elephant conservationist once named a Time magazine Hero of Asia. While the journey of this elephant, Noi Na, forms the core of Love and Bananas, the film also more broadly examines the plight of Asian elephants and the jarring decrease in their population. The movie also examines the crush box, the barbaric means by which all captive Asian elephants are broken after first being separated from their mothers as babies. Movie fans familiar with Ashley Bell's on-screen work, she perhaps best known for her acclaimed work in horror films, may be surprised her off-screen foray as a director is this documentary, which will screen, by the way, June 30th at the Jemmy B. Kiel Regional Library in Tampa. We'll find out why she chose to make this film, how it came about, what she thinks more people should know about Asian elephants, and more when I speak with Ashley Bell in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak with Tara Lawler, Senior Director of Strategic Campaigns and Special Projects at the Humane Society of the United States, or HSUS, about a mammoth spay-neuter effort undertaken in Puerto Rico earlier this month by HSUS and several other organizations, which in 7 days resulted in more than 5,000 dogs and cats being spayed or neutered. We'll hear about that initiative deeper into the program. Lastly, as you may know, I occasionally write for the Washington Post animal-oriented blog, and some of those stories go on to run in various newspapers nationally, including the Post itself. I collaborated with my editor on a piece that was just published Friday. It explores the issue of domestic violence shelters that do and do not accommodate pets. The story is partly the byproduct of a Talking Animals interview I did May 2nd with Lariana Forsyth, the interim CEO of CASA, the domestic violence shelter in Pinellas County, which opened a kennel in early March, enabling survivors to take refuge there with their pets. As few as 3% of domestic violence shelters nationally can take pets, the Post piece delves into various aspects of this situation, and I reported from CASA, including interviewing a survivor staying there with her golden retriever, Cody. If you're interested in reading the story, it was posted and shared multiple times on my personal Facebook page, or you can just Google Washington Post, domestic violence shelters, and pet friendly. Right now, though, let's get to Ashley with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Ashley Bell on Talking Animals. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for joining us this morning on Talking Animals. I know it's bright and early for you out in California, so I appreciate it all the more.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Really, thank you.
For sure. So the opening part of the film touches on this briefly, but to provide greater understanding and context, I'd like to ask you to describe your feelings about elephants long before undertaking the film project.
You know, I was never really an elephant person in the sense that I didn't have elephant pillows or elephant you know, figurines everywhere or anything. I found out about this because of what I saw with my own eyes and experienced with my own eyes. I'd known about world-renowned Asian elephant conservationist Lek Shilert for about 15 years before doing this film. I knew of her as this indomitable force and this hero in Thailand that was working on the front lines every day to save this species. I'd always been an animal rights activist and a vegetarian, a vegan. And I learned through a family friend who ran the Cambodia Wildlife Sanctuary that with Lex's help, they were looking to rescue Asian elephants for 10 years to bring to this sanctuary, but they weren't able to find them because there are so few Asian elephants left. And I got an email, I remember it clear as day, that said, we found these first two elephants. Anybody that wants to come to see them released onto the sanctuary can come. And it hit me. And I was like, I got to go. This is a happily ever after story. It's a short film. I pitched the concept to a production company. Within a week we were there. And what we found was incredibly shocking. The forest was being illegally logged and poached. The elephants were in horrendous physical condition. We were briefly surrounded by the Cambodian military. And it was a very grim reality. But I saw the footage of what it took to bring the elephants there on Lex Tyler's iPad. And it was the most harrowing, victorious, uplifting footage I'd ever seen. And I said, that's the story. That's the story that's demanding to be told of what one person is doing every day on the front lines to help save this species. I asked Lex if we could come with her on an elephant rescue. And she said, if you could hang, you could come. And I was like, I'm going to figure out how to hang, but we're coming. And that's Love and Bananas.
So a few things right off the bat. It sounded like that you set out to be involved in this and make a short documentary. And as you say, it was going to be, at least at the time, a happily ever after story. And then when you touched down there, it was a whole different set of circumstances that I guess became apparent to you. Once you and Lex worked out, if you could arrange, I guess, the scheduling and the logistics that you could stay longer, was it immediately apparent that it was going to be, hey, this isn't a short little capturing of what happened here. This is definitely a feature-length doc, and to really even give this justice, do justice to this.
It wasn't. It was always going to be what's best for the story, and we were going to let the story dictate the length. We actually really wanted something that would be really appropriate for the youth, for the next generation, to bring into classrooms, to be appropriate, to watch, to be low on graphic content, high on solution, that would stick. So we were like, well, is it a webisode? Is it a series of Instagram videos? Is it a short? We wanted something very, very compatible. When we actually shot the film and came back with the footage, we were like, I think we have enough content to take audiences on a feature length story. So
I see. Yeah. Because it sounded like when you set out, at least in the film, you say that your intention at that point, at least, was to make a short documentary about the experience. So it sounds like, over the course of your time there, and then maybe what all you shot, that it just naturally evolved into a full length.
Yeah, and it was interesting because from that first trip to actually going back to doing the principal shooting, it was 2.5 years. We waited 2.5 years with, I think, 2 false starts.
Oh,
where
wow.
There was an elephant available for rescue, but, I get a message from Lex and we would mobilize here and then in 24 hours it would be sold off to a circus, or it would be, they would end up charging more money for it, or it would go to a different trekking camp, which is elephant riding. When we actually did get the message to go, we had to mobilize very, very quickly, and we assembled a team of myself and 3 guys, and we left, we had about a week to get out and get there. And
wow.
Literally, we touched down, and we're on the back of a truck with Noi Na, the elephant that's rescued in the film, traveling 500 miles across Thailand to freedom.
Wow, so it had to move quickly because it sounds like there had already been these, as you say, false starts where you thought, wow, that window is tiny and it could close, or the elephant isn't going to be available or going to be sent off to do something else if we don't get there immediately.
Absolutely, yeah. They can disappear that quickly through your fingers, definitely.
Yeah, well, I want to come back more and have you kind of explain more what, in this instance, at least, rescue means. But early in the film, you provide a primer of sorts noting the physical and other differences between African and Asian elephants, information that is always good and probably mostly reviewed for those people who are sort of longtime elephant fans. But that section did also offer some really eye-opening information, including the plight of the Asian elephant and maybe even more so their dramatically dwindling numbers. Can you walk us through those numbers, especially maybe as compared to the African elephants who have obviously their own significant plight?
Well, of course. Well, there are now 415,000 African elephants left in the world, but only 40,000 Asian elephants. A third of them are in captivity, and in some parts of southern China, they're functionally extinct. I recently asked Lack, what is the difference? Why is there such a drastic difference between the numbers? And she explained that because in Southeast Asia, those elephants are literally being used for all forms of business. They're being used, captured from the wild, and used for entertainment in zoos, circuses, and for trekking, which is elephant rides. Most recently, there's been a huge demand for body parts. Elephants are being used, their body parts are being sold on the black market for elephant skins, for eyelashes, for tips of the trunk. And they're also being used as service animals because in parts of Southeast Asia, they need elephants for logging, so that elephants work deep in the jungle, and they pull the big mahogany teak and rubber tree. So they don't. And in addition, medicine for medicinal purposes, which kind of go into the
body parts
category.
Yeah.
In addition, because cities and agriculture are so condensed throughout Southeast Asia, the route where elephants normally migrate has been intercepted by farms or by cities. So literally there's no place for them to go anymore. That's wild.
Yeah. Wow. All right. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Ashley Bell, the actress who directed Love and Bananas, An Elephant Story, a documentary chronicling the rescue in Thailand of a 7-year-old partially blind Asian elephant and the ensuing 480-mile trek to a sanctuary and a new life for that elephant. The film will screen June 30th at Jimmy B. Kiel Regional Library here in Tampa. If you'd like to ask Ashley a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. I actually have one caller eager to speak, so let's do that, and then I want to get back to you with questions about rescuing this instance. But hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ashley Bell.
Yes, first of all, I want to thank Ashley for bringing this story to light. I think the more people see elephants and their plight, the more it will generate political will to protect them. I was hoping that you would comment on several different topics. One is elephant sentience, social structure, and intelligence. My view from research is that they exceed humans in many ways in their sentience, their consciousness, and their social structures, especially their memory and their family grouping. The second is the Trump administration, especially Ryan Zinke, who have been flip-flopping on banning things that would promote or work against elephant trophy hunting, with Zinke promoting it, and of course Trump's sons are trophy hunters in Africa. The third would be the use of elephants for anything other than leaving them in their native habitat, especially circuses.
Okay, well, Ashley, you can take one or more of those in whatever order you'd like. And
great, absolutely, yes. They're the elephant's intelligence and the social structure of them is one of the things that, I mean, so much of elephants is absolutely remarkable, but that's also what you see actually happening at Elephant Nature Park, which is Lex Sanctuary, is so much of mothering and survival is passed down through the herd. You see that with the new babied rescued elephants that get brought to the sanctuary that are inducted by the herd and taught by nannies, super nannies. The whole family rallies around to help these elephants. One of the most remarkable things I heard Lex say is that when an elephant is getting ready to give birth, don't watch, if it's a young elephant, don't watch the mom, watch the midwife. And I was like, wait, you're kidding me. There's a midwife in an elephant family structure? And she said, there is. There has to be an elephant that teaches the younger elephant mothers what to do. And in the wild, when an elephant gets ready to give birth, the midwife, you know, as the mother begins to drop fluid, the midwife will actually be covering up any sense any fluid or anything so that the scent will be hidden. And elephants are vegetarian creatures. They will actually eat the placenta to make sure that that no predators can find them. So, you know, this is so important when you look at elephants in zoos and circuses that are chained or do not have adequate area to roam or do not have friends and companions, because you can see that that this is part of their life, that they need this family structure to survive, and mentally they are wired to be a herd species. They need to travel that amount of distances for stimulation and communication, and this knowledge and this sense of family is ingrained in the herd and passed down. You know, with the Trump administration, I always go back to what Lex says, and recently she was in New York talking about this right when he flip-flopped the first time, and Lex said, who's Ty, Lex said, we look to America as the platform to set the standard, and it needs to change. These species are at the brink of extinction, and America needs to be a standard of what should be. We should be leading the charge for animals and for humanity. So we have to work together to stop this.
Well, I certainly understand and agree with what Lick was trying to say there. I mean, maybe especially at the moment,
yeah. That's
even harder to embrace, but mm-hmm. But doesn't mean we shouldn't still aspire to it. But so let's talk more about what, in this instance, we've referred a few different times to rescuing and how when you went back, you were sort of primed a couple different times to go rescue an elephant that, for one reason or another, was no longer available, got used for something else, sent somewhere else. So when we are talking about rescuing Asian elephants in Thailand or nearby areas, what do we really mean? Rescuing from what?
Well, in this case, we rescued an elephant named Noi Na, which was a 70-year-old, partially blind Asian elephant from a trekking camp, and that is elephant riding. So Noi Na was used to give, for entertainment, for tourists that come from around the world to take elephant rides. Interestingly, though, elephants have what Lex refers to as an elephant passport, so you can actually track their history of where they've worked their entire life. So Noi Na, being a 70-year-old elephant, had actually gone back and forth from being used for entertainment, for elephant riding, to logging, which was, pulling logs deep in the jungle, to elephant trekking, to riding, to elephant trekking, to riding. She spent years and years in service.
And so when there's the other elephants that at first you thought maybe you guys would go and be able to film the rescue, were they ensconced in sort of similar situations and or similar patterns as Noi Na was?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I believe so. I believe that the one other elephant was a logging elephant, and she was, 48 hours when we were trying to get going, she had been sold to a circus. The elephants that I met at the very first elephants I ever met in my life that we feature at the beginning of the film in Cambodia were released from a logging, were rescued from a logging facility, which is just incredibly common for elephants. And that's where a lot of their major injuries come when they're trying to pull those huge logs through the jungle.
And I'm sort of loath to ask about this in part because I think it's safe to say so many of us are devastated by what's been happening at the borders in recent days, which bear, unfortunately, some similarities. But I sort of feel like it's incumbent for this conversation to spend just at least a moment or two discussing the crush box. So for those listening who are fortunate enough so far to not be familiar with the crush box, give us as much or as little. Again, I don't want to necessarily delve into too much of it just because, again, I think a lot of people are kind of fragile at the moment. But because so much of what everything else that you described that these elephants are forced to do all springs from this first experience, I think we do need to at least address it briefly.
Of course. And take in mind, you know, with talking about the plight of the Asian elephant, but with Love and Bananas, we wanted to make a film that was, that people could feel safe watching. We kept it low on this graphic content just to set the stage of what these elephants are facing, and then we're off on a rescue. So with the Crush Box, this was the moment that kind of was my aha moment and compelled me to feel the need to do something, anything, my part. So every single captive Asian elephant in the world has one thing in common, and that's been that they've been through a process known as the Crush Box, turn them from a wild animal into a service animal. The Crush Box is a process where they're taken from their mothers and as babies, and they're put in a box. Their legs are tied up, and they're beat straight for 24 hours for a week until the bond between the baby and the mother is replaced by the fear of man and the fear of whatever tool man is using. If this doesn't work in the first 24 hours, it's repeated for another and another until it works. And this practice is used throughout the world to essentially break an elephant spirit.
So any elephant that you see in a circus or at elephant rides at the county fair, or much less, you know, service there, like you've talked about,
right,
logging and other things, they've all first gone through the Crush Box.
That's true, yeah. Because when you see an elephant in the wild, that will be the last thing you see.
Yeah.
No, I don't, you know, look, many people can see elephants in the wild. But when, you know, if you went up to, you need to remember that even though people ride, you can see people riding elephants, these are not domesticated animals. They're not domesticated like horses. Elephants don't breed well in captivity. So when you see elephants, they cannot be, the species cannot be bred down and domesticated for this kind of service. It's not in their nature. They are wild animals. They come from a wild line, and in order to get them to do this, in order to get on them or to use them for entertainment, they have to be broken.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's probably.
And mind you, this is the work and the footage of Lex Tyler. She trusted us with this footage. She's been working on the front lines for 20 years across Southeast Asia. And gathering footage like this, her life has been on the line. She's faced constant persecution to get this message out and to get this footage out, just to get the true story about what Asian elephants are facing. So that footage is thanks to her.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about her, because for my money, it's become a little bit hackneyed to call someone a whisperer, the dog whisperer, the lion whisperer, and so on. But she truly does seem like the elephant whisperer.
Right.
And just has this profound understanding of elephants, what they're thinking, what their source of anxiety is, when they've relaxed into a new situation and when they haven't. I mean, it's pretty remarkable just as you present her in the film. So you said part of what spurred this initially was being aware of her. But
yes.
When did you first hear about her, and under what circumstances?
I first learned about her through my family friend, David Castleman, who owns the Cambodia Wildlife Sanctuary. They've been working together for 10 years prior to the start of this film. And I, you know, just having been animal aware, animal rights aware, trying to be conscious of the environment, she's a rock star in that world. And I was actually quite tongue-tied and a little bit speechless when I met her. She is the elephant whisperer in every sense. There was a moment I that's actually our poster image that I will have saved in the deepest part of my heart for my entire life, is where Lek like took me to meet the herd, and if and when you see the film, you'll see this moment. But I got a chance to sit next to Lek and be surrounded by 8 elephants.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely incredible. I only got that spot because I was with Lek, who is mom to them. And they trust her. And I sat next to Lek. She laid out a buffet of zucchinis for them. And they gathered from the far corners of the park to greet her and eat this gift of peanuts and zucchinis and some bananas. And I looked up, and to literally be sitting in between an elephant's legs and to look up and to see that, it was one of the most remarkable things I've ever been a part of. And, you know, they trust her.
Well, it was so powerful because, yeah. You know, for you, obviously, for anybody, if they could imagine themselves in that same situation, it would have been super powerful. And yet, one of the great sort of contrasts about it is that she was almost sort of matter of fact saying, well, they've because you're with me, they've accepted you into the herd, and like, there you go. That's it. So it was just a measure of, again, how long she's been working with these animals and how well she knows them. And again, the incredible bond that she's forged, that indeed that she could just bring in someone that they'd never seen before, presumably you, and they would just say, okay, well, if she is with Lek, then she's cool. She's okay.
I would add something, but literally you've explained it perfectly. Yeah.
Okay.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. So given the time that you spent with her, because really for those, most people probably haven't yet seen the film. And again, it is, the screening will be unticketed, as we like to say, on June 30th at Jimmy B. Keel Regional Library. And that's being presented by Florida Voices for Animals. And there is a Facebook event page that you can search for details about that. But they're going to serve some food first and then show the film, and it's going to be great. But anyways, again, most people listening, I figure, have not seen the film. So she's really part of this whole trek from the moment you guys get together with the elephant. I have difficulty even loading her into the truck, but otherwise she's on her way to freedom, effectively, and a new life. Lek is there every step of the way and sort of really guiding people and offering her considerable expertise. So she's really, in some ways, kind of along with Noi Na, the sort of the star of the film, in a sense.
Yes, no, absolutely. Yes, Lek and Noi Na are the stars of the film, absolutely.
You know, I mentioned earlier in the show, and some folks would know you from your work in, like, The Last Exorcism, Dark Intentions, Psychopath, etc., the work that you've done in front of the camera. But what had been your experience behind the camera prior to this as director?
I studied directing at NYU and at Cambridge. It was more in the sense of theater directing. But, you know, it's interesting, as an actor, I always feel that the work really starts in between jobs. When you're on a job, it's absolute heaven. You're exposed to, first of all, you're lucky enough to be creating art for a living. You have access to one of the most fascinating microcosms in the world. I mean, you're on a set with experts of their field. And because of that, you know, there's downtime. I would always go and ask, what does this mean? How did you do this? Why was this chosen? And because I've worked a lot in independent films, they've been the most open, collaborative environment. And I'm not saying I go, you know, you sense when to ask these questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've learned a lot that way. I'd always wanted to direct. I thought it would be way later in my life than a narrative. So this was a surprise to me as well. But for the 5 years I've been doing it, it's been the most artistic and rewarding, creatively rewarding experience of my life. To, you know, even in the downtime in between jobs, to always have a passion project to go to, always have an artistic outlet, always be collaborating and writing with musicians or color correctors or camera operator, or editor, everything, to be able to work in that world. Everything I hoped for in kind of starting my career.
Sure. So what number of years did, from start to finally releasing the film, did this project span?
It took 4 years. But, you know, 2.5 years of that was waiting for an elephant to be available for rescue.
Sure.
So the actual filming of it was fast and furious. We filmed for 2 weeks and got in and got out. And then with documentary, you know, we had 75 hours of footage to cut
wow.
to
oh my
75 goodness. Minutes. So the editing, the post process took a year, which is quick, I heard, for documentaries.
Yeah.
And then it took about a year to sell it. But I collaborated with an incredible production company from day one called Change for Balance Productions. I both shot and edited the film with them. And we partnered with Fernanda, or not partnered, but we worked with Fernanda Rossi as our co-writer to help carve out this footage. Fernanda Rossi is an incredible documentary writer, and she's been nominated 2 times for an Academy Award.
Yeah, because there's like a real narrative here that, especially with 75 hours of footage, that would be essential to sort of carve out that path with a real story that we do follow and we get really involved with. And again, along the way, there's other information about Asian elephants generally and some other things that are also offered. But it really is overall a story of this elephant that's had this sort of long, rough road, figuratively, then going literally on the road to freedom and a whole new life.
Yeah, and there was one, you know, we'd prepared, and there's one major element of the film which happened completely unexpectedly when we were there. We called it our miracle factor. And that's a scene where, when we're at the trekking camp, Lek has convinced the trekking camp owner to take his elephants, or some of his elephants, the elephants that will have to remain at the trekking camp, for a walk through the jungle without chains for the first time. And it took like 3 years to convince this owner to do this. And he agreed to let 5 of his elephants go on this jungle walk. And what we captured, we show directly as it happened in the film, almost minute for minute, the physical transformation of the elephants and the physical and emotional, I should say, transformation of the elephants and the trekking camp owner. And spoiler alert, I don't want to ruin it, so people will have to see what happened. But
yeah,
it was at that moment that we were like, sitting in the edit, and we were like, well, I'm the first to be like, I'm not going to carry on this film. I'm going to let the content call it. We're not in the game to extend footage or to waste people's time. And it was dealing with that footage where we were like, okay, we have a story that's compelling enough to tell, or we felt, and hold people by the work Lek does, how she works, the spirit and hope with which she works, and that was the moment where it kind of went from where we went into the feature length decision.
No doubt.
Yeah.
So again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Stress. My guest is Ashley Bell, who directed Love in Bananas, An Elephant Story, a documentary chronicling the rescue in Thailand of a 7-year-old partially blind Asian elephant, Noi Na. The film was screened June 30th at Jimmy B. Keel Regional Library in Tampa. We have just a couple minutes or so left with Ashley, but if you'd like to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Please do. And an email we got actually was from Diane Kuhn of Florida Voices for Animals, just saying, hi Duncan, I just wanted to thank Ashley Bell for making this incredible documentary about the Asian elephants. While watching it, felt like I was there also. So well done, and I'm so impressed by the dedication of the people who are helping these elephants, especially Lek. And also thanks for allowing Florida Voices for Animals the privilege to show this film to the Tampa Bay area. We're honored to be able to help any way we can. So that's from Diane. So.
Well, thank you, Florida Voices.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for bringing this film to your area. This film has been so unpredictable. When we were getting ready to release, we had no idea how it would land. And we originally set out to have a release at 20 theaters nationwide.
Mm.
And I heard earlier in the week where we just crossed 75 and we're getting close to 80.
Wow.
Theatrical screenings nationwide. And what's been so exciting is the kids that have shown up at screenings and being able to go into classrooms and present this film to schools at both junior high Well, elementary school, we've gone to fifth grade, elementary school, junior high, and high school. Again, I know a lot of the realities of elephants and the true plight that they're facing was talked about. But we wanted to make a film where people wouldn't be scared to watch it. So we really strove to keep, again, that graphic content low and high on what we can do in the States. I think all of us are faced with the decision to, when you hear about something, to help or not. And my goal would be for that people to not be paralyzed by an issue, to know that even if they do one thing, especially for a species so close to extinction, it really, really matters.
Yeah. Well, let me quickly add that the website is loveandbananas.com, and information about screenings and where you can see it is available there. I'd be curious, Ashley, to effectively go four times as many theaters as you initially projected. Has that been based on word of mouth, reviews? I mean, what accounts for that? That's obviously quite an impressive bump up.
Thank you. It's been both. The word of mouth has been absolutely incredible. It's kept on rolling. And reviews. I mean, we were prepared from our distributor to, you know, when we were going to New York and Lex was coming to the United States to do press, we were, you know, well, as an actor too, you know, you just get ready for what you put into the world. That Thursday before we opened, that Thursday morning, I got an email and then a phone call that said, check your email. We got a review from the New York Times that was glowing, and that where we were like, okay, hold on. And as of right now, we have a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow. Yeah, no, I saw that review, and it was small, relatively speaking, but mighty in terms of its words and its praise of the film. So I thought, oh my goodness, this is going to, came out a while ago now, but certainly alter things considerably, I would think. So yeah, it sounds like that's exactly what happened. So
absolutely.
In our last moment or so here, Ashley, I'd just be curious to know, especially because things just seem to be, whether it's someone as magical as Leck or kind of magical good fortune as, you know, a really nice, favorable New York Times review. They may or may not have been expecting them even to review it at all, and all kinds of other cool things that have happened. Mm-hmm. So I'd just be curious to know, in what ways did working on this film change you most profoundly?
I'd have to say it helped me find my voice.
Mm.
I think, you know, as an actor, your job is to serve the text, serve the script, serve the director, and that's my favorite part of it. You know, the choices are bigger than you. And when I saw the work Leck was doing on the front lines and her spirit of hope and perseverance against all odds, it seemed, it inspired me to such a degree, it changed my lens. I said, I have to do it. I can't just tweet or post this. I have to offer whatever I have to offer to help get this out to the world in some way, or help move the needle, or just do what I can for her and for this species. And it drove me to making this. And for the 5 years I've been doing it, to have a concept and stick to it helped me to find my voice. So I thank the elephants for that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, again, elephants are impressive creatures in so many ways. So, actually, we have just reached the end of our time here. We've been speaking with Ashley Bell, the director of Love and Bananas, An Elephant Story. Again, the website is loveandbananas.com. There's also Facebook and other social media for the film. And again, as a reminder, speaking of social media, the movie will screen later this month, June 30th, at Jimmy B. Kiel Regional Library. And there is a Facebook event page for that. So there's eats and kind of cool treats beforehand, and then the screening itself, so that's all in store. So Ashley, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals and making this wonderful film.
Thank you so much. Yes, and I just wanted to share also that because of the response we got, if you're in LA or New York, there's going to be a week-long engagement starting July 20th, and at the same time we're going to be launching exclusively on iTunes at the end of July, and we will be having our broadcast release on Stars on July 30th.
Wow.
So
lots of cool things on the horizon.
Lots of cool things at the tip of your fingers or with your remote, you can be able to find us everywhere very soon. So
that's exciting.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Thanks again, Ashley. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye now. In a few moments, I'll speak with Tara Lawler of the Humane Society of the United States about that gigantic spay-neuter initiative in Puerto Rico earlier this month, in which more than 5,000 cats and dogs were spayed-neutered. Right now, it's time to step into the comedy corner. This is Jeff Wayne with a piece called The Wolf, the Bear, and the Alligator in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
So I get to the condo, I unpack, and I thought, well, I'm going to go out and take a walk and take a look at Alaska. Look outside, there's a wolf out there. I call the condo manager. Hey, there's a wolf out there.
Well, that's Ray.
What do I care what his name is? I didn't travel 2,000 miles to be on a first name basis with a wolf.
Oh, he's a pet. Just call him to you.
This isn't the object of what my desire is. I'm afraid of this thing, so I stayed in the condo all that week because this pet wolf's out running around. I'm not tangling with a wolf. The next week, I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska. Now, this is incredible. Very small city. I can't wait to get out and look around. And the club manager tells me, now, listen, don't go on the outskirts of town. There's bears. They'll attack you. What's happening here? He says, sometimes they come in this city and attack people. So this is terrible. He said, well, if one sees you, act like you're dead. I said, brother, I won't have to act. He'll just come over and sniff you for a little while. He's not going to be smelling me long, I'll tell you that. Said he's going to test to see if you're dead or not. He's going to take his paw and bang you in the chest a couple times, but don't make any noise. Do you know how big a bear's paw is? Cracking my ribs make no noise? So he said, well, if you can't act like you're dead, then find a hill to run down. Now imagine this. You're out here, here's a bear. And you're supposed to say, stop, let me find a hill. I don't know the geography of this area. Why do I want to run down a hill? Well, the bear's front legs are shorter than his back legs, and he can't run down the hill. That's right. He'll roll and be waiting for me at the bottom. A month later, I'm in Miami, Florida, and I'm playing golf. We're next to a canal. I see this thing that looks like a log move. Uh-oh, watch out. I said, what is that? That looks like an alligator. The guy next to me, that's a gator. Keep your eye on that ball. I'm going to keep my eye on that alligator. Brother, that's a handicap right there. And none of these people seem that nervous about any of this. So I said to him, I said, well, I guess, you know, you're sort of comfortable because we can outrun that alligator. Oh, no, no, no. Alligator goes 35 miles an hour, fast as a man. Knocks you over with the tail, grabs you with the teeth, drags you under the water, drowns you, and eats you for a couple days. I don't need this information. Came out a crappy golfer. Now I'm winding up a human snack bar. But if the alligator starts to run after you, zigzag, because he can't zig, that's it, stop. His name is Ray, run down a hill, it's over.
That was Jeff Wayne with a piece called The Wolf, the Bear, and the Alligator, taken from his album, The Jeff Comedy Jam. Okay, on to Tara Lawler of the Humane Society of the United States to discuss that sprawling spay-neuter initiative carried out in Puerto Rico earlier this month. This is Tara Lawler on Talking Animals. Good morning, Tara.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So this seems like an enormous undertaking. How did it come about?
Well, we responded to the natural disaster, and with that, we obtained an executive order which allowed us to bring in for the first time outside vets from the continental United States and beyond to help with the emergencies and all of the animal care. And after that, there were still a lot of animals that were in great need. And then we also saw a rise in abandonment because people really had no options. The airlines made it really prohibitive for people to fly out with their pets. Bigger dogs had a really difficult time getting out. So we saw a rise in the street population. So I spoke with the governor and the first lady, and I asked for an extension of that order. And with that, then we started working with the local veterinary association and the veterinary board. And we deep dived into a plan to spay-neuter over 20,000 animals and provide vaccines all for free. In areas of great need. And after that, I just started basically building a coalition of 22 other organizations from a around the world, actually, to partake in this effort. And we just really just all came together, and it was a great solidarity for animals.
Wow. I was going to ask how many organizations, and so you've answered that, 22. How many veterinarians were also involved in this effort?
So there's multiple teams. There's surgical teams, and then there's ground teams, and then there's the HSUS teams at each of the different sites. So we have 8 teams operating throughout the island, and with that, there's 23 organizations, including the Humane Society of the United States, as part of this. So each different team represents a different role. So we have all of these teams operating at the same time. The surgical teams usually have at least 7 surgeons cutting at once, and the largest team has over 15. We're able to do a lot, and in the first week, we did 5,608 animals.
Holy cow. That's truly impressive. Now, so there's 22 organizations, all kinds of vets.
23 total, including HSUS.
Oh, okay, right, of course, sorry. Yes, that's a huge mistake on my part. So it's hard to add 1 to 22 for some reason. But anyway, the thing is, it would seem like with that many organizations and surgical teams and other things, it would be a little bit like the proverbial herding kittens to put this together. I mean, so were you or someone at HSUS along with you, like, overseeing this, just because it seemed like someone basically has to be in charge?
Yeah, so this is my baby. I was working 90-plus hours a week, and I have a small team that were right by my side and doing fantastic work. It's never been done before, that many organizations coming together, and it is an unprecedented group coming together, so I'm really proud of it. We wanted to make sure that we did it right, because we had one chance to make it fly, and we were really, really proud of the first go. We have 3 more rounds left, too.
Yeah, so when are the next big spayathons, as I guess they've been called?
Sure. The next one is November 1 through 10. Mm-hmm. The one after that is February 1 through 10, and the last one is May 1 through 10.
Wow.
And basically, it's all in, and we have everybody from PetSmart Charities, Banfield, Maddie's Fund, Petco, PetSmart, and then all of the government of Puerto Rico. Everybody has a significant role and really making it all come together.
Yeah, it sounds truly amazing. And it also sounds like that the initial numbers that you guys were seeking to hit are going to be exceeded, right, at the rate you're going?
Yeah, we initially said 20,000 in my head.
Yeah.
I had no doubt that we're going to at least do 25,000.
Right.
The teams are super excited. After this first round, I had over 100 vets from all over the world email me about being part of it, which then I direct them to the surgical leads. The surgical teams form their full teams. We just basically give them the platform to come in with the executive order. They have a waiver, and it gives them a provisional license so they can legally operate in Puerto Rico.
And so with this many organizations, 23, I'd like to point out, in total, are some of those providing the funding so as to make this no cost to the folks in Puerto Rico that are getting their dogs and cats spayed or neutered?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
There's the foundations that have given money, and then there's also private donors, ones that are fans of this work and really supportive. And, I was able to formulate this coalition in a matter of about 3 weeks.
Wow.
And we raised $1.2 million in that time frame for this initiative. So making sure that it's all free, including the vaccines and exemplary vet care. So we're really, really excited about that.
And so on these other ones in November, February, May, et cetera, do you guys have it now pretty much all set and covered? Like if someone heard this and said, hey, I'd love to volunteer or help out, I've got some time, vacation time I could take to go help out. Are you seeking volunteers of that kind, or is it?
Yeah, right now we have vets can absolutely still email us about that. And then veterinary techs, we're definitely still in the need of that.
Okay.
As you know, a vet only performs as well with great techs behind them. So that's absolutely needed. Our HSUS staff is full. We are completely full in that one. I had people from all over the organization want and care about Puerto Rico. So
sure.
That part's been great. And then we have ground teams like the Sado Project, Humane Society of Puerto Rico, and different other aspects of teams that they also need volunteers. So they're in the coalition, there's lots of opportunities to partake.
So I guess someone interested to find out more about that could just go to hsus.org and then find whatever section or tab
for Tara
or something.
Lawler.
Yeah. Okay. So, okay, cool. So again, it's Tara, TaraLoller. If you are looking for more information on how you can help out and get involved in these subsequent excursions there. So Tara, thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals and congrats on pulling off a pretty astounding feat and three more behind
it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks again.
Okay. Have a great night.
You too.
Bye.
Thanks. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Laura and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour Midpoint with Nola Lillay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. The music kicks back in at 2 with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. And next week on this show, my guests will be Christopher Buttle and Eleanor Spicer Rice, co-authors of Dr. Eleanor's book of Common Spiders. It's Talking Animals on WNF Tampa.